Welcome to Game the Passion with hosts Todd Foster, Alyssa Stanley, and Kelly Scar.
All right, welcome to the Game the Passion podcast. On today's show, we've got Dr. A. Michael Abelson. Welcome to the show, my friend.
Great to be here, and I'm looking forward to our time together today.
Absolutely. As long as Todd doesn't totally screw this up, I think we're going to have a great show in front of us. So listen, for our audience that doesn't know you, why don't you give us a quick preamble of your history, who you are, and what you're all about?
Well, I'm a weird duck because I have a master's in clinical psychology. I was actually a clinical psychologist for a little while, but I also have an MBA and a PhD in business management. So I walk in both paths at the same time, basically. So in our organization, we use both of those things. I am a retired emeritus professor of business from Texas A&M, but I'm not your typical professor either, because I have done over 1,000 speeches. We have hundreds and hundreds of projects that we've done with businesses. So we're very, very applied. And what we do now is we have incredible psychological assessment tools that identify people's behaviors and motives and emotional intelligence and leadership skills and how they deal with stress. And we show organizations how to use that for hiring, for team building, for coaching, for personal development, for anything that deals with individuals. So that's what we specialize in now. We do an incredible amount of training, and we actually do consulting. So we have different consulting products that we integrate a number of the assessment tools to show people really how to understand people.
I took one of your DISC assessments when we were going through a coaching certification course here last year in summer of 2021. And we were talking before we started, hit the record button on the show, about how absolutely accurate this thing was. It was about 99.8%. I remember printing it off and giving it to my wife and saying, here, read through this thing. And she's like, how in the world did this thing absolutely nail you? Like, just almost 100% nailed me, right down to the simple little nuances about, you know, the certain, you know, things that kind of jam me up every once in a while and, you know, take away my focus and all that, all the rest of that kind of, it's just incredible. Talk to us a little bit about how that system works and how it is so accurate.
There are dozens of DISC assessments and behavioral assessments out there, right? Some of them are just terrible. There are a couple that are pretty good. We're told all the time by people that have taken multiple of these things that without a doubt, ours is the most accurate and easiest to use and to understand. It's a pretty complicated process, but the real neat thing is we have a behavioral assessment, the DISC, we have a motives assessment, and those are the two that most of our clients use. But you can take those assessments in less than 20 minutes. Whereas a lot of these other assessment tools, you know, can take 45 minutes to an hour. So there's all kinds of additional negative issues. But the assessments are renormed every couple years. We change the language because languages change. And words that meant something 5 years ago may mean something different now. So the assessments are updated. And that's one of the reasons they're so darn accurate. And what we typically find, and I've done three studies myself on the assessments, what we find is that about 75% of the people tell us it's 95% accurate or greater. And we have around 90% of the people that tell us it's 90% accurate or greater. And very, very rarely do we ever have anybody who tells us it's less than 85 or 80% accurate. And in those cases, we just tell them, hey, let's wait a couple of days or wait a week or so, and then why don't you retake it? And let's see what happens the second time around. Because for us, anything less than 90%, especially anything less than 85%, is not accurate enough for us to want to use with our clients, because it's got to be accurate. It's got to be right if you're going to be using an assessment tool for hiring decisions or team building or just to communicate with different people.
Would you say that the mindset that the person is in is critical to the outcome when they take the test?
It really isn't. Our assessments are very, very stable, and they're not impacted much by what's going on for the person at that time, which is great. I mean, we've had people that have taken it with a 102 fever, all right, and it's still incredibly accurate. And they're looking at it and saying, oh my God, how is that so accurate? I was feeling lousy when I took it, right? So as long as they can focus and as long as they're paying attention to the questions and answering them and not overthinking. A lot of times when it's less than 85% accurate, it's because you're just overthinking. So we just say, hey, just relax, take it again. And all of a sudden, the accuracy goes up just because they're just being themselves and they're answering the question.
For our listeners that don't know what the DISC really is, so there's a DISC. Could you give us a brief description of exactly what a D and I an SNFC is, and maybe even relate it to someone that we may know, famous or a celebrity?
Okay, well, it's kind of interesting. Well, the Ds are people who are very, very dominant. They're very, very competitive. They like to be in control of things. So they're typically interested in power types of relationships. Most of your big name politicians that you're going to see are going to have quite a bit of D in them. All right, the I refers to influencers. All right, and what happens there is they like to talk. They're very loyal. They like to befriend you. A stranger is a person who they have not had an opportunity to befriend yet. And there's all kinds of energy that they typically bring to the room and to the group. All right. Jim Curry is in the mask. I like to use that one because all of a sudden when he puts his mask on, he is this high energy, all right, type of individual. S deals with steadiness, and steadiness are people who like to be kind of like in the background. They don't like to be in the center of attention, but they're very, very collegial. They're very, very family oriented. They don't like conflict. They like to bring people together to deal with things. All right. Somebody like that would be Barbara Bush. For those of you who remember Barbara Bush, she is definitely, you know, the mother, you know, figure. And then C deals with compliance or conscientiousness. And with that, what happens is they're very, very detailed. They're very, very quality oriented, typical engineering profile or typical, you know, accountant who isn't very emotional. Would be your C, you know, type of individual. So those are the four basic styles. But what's the most important aspect of that is one of the neat things about our behavioral profile is only about 7% of the population is an intense D, I, S, or C. That means around 93% of the population is a blend, which is really important. A lot of people, what happens is they get this notion of what a D is, and all these Ds are this one type of D. Well, our assessment actually looks at 384 different profiles. So there's actually 96 different levels of D, all right? There's the same thing for I, S, and C. So it's important to realize that there's a blending, number one. Number two, most people tell you that a DISC is a personality profile. It is not a personality profile. Our personalities are much more complicated than just this. This just measures behaviors. So if you're interested in behavior assessment, then get a really good DISC assessment. That'll help you do it. Some of you have taken the Myers-Briggs. That's not a behavioral assessment. They tell you it is, but it's really a cognitive assessment. It's how we think and how we judge and make decisions. All right. So you need to be careful what you have. That's why we have so many different types of assessments, because we do want to give you a better flavor of what the person's really like. So that's why we measure the behaviors. That's why we measure motives, because we want to know what's driving that behavior. You can have two people who are very, very similar on the DISC, but are very different people. Well, one of the reasons for that is their motives may be different. Their emotional intelligence may be different. Right. So that might be another reason. So we like to measure that. Of course, we'll work with what our client wants to do, but we have the ability to get into a lot of different dynamics and a lot of different aspects of what the person is really like. And those are just about half of the assessments.
I'm curious, you know, from a hiring perspective, you know, for a company that, you know, Fortune 500, Fortune 1000, Fortune 10,000, doesn't matter. How big the company is. Are you like, should you be using Myers-Briggs? Should you be using DISCs? Should you be using all of these different types of assessments to really drill down into the person that you're potentially bringing on into your company? And then do you kind of lay that over top of your core values to see if that person would be a good employee, a good contributor to the company? Is that something that you would recommend, Dr. Ray?
More and more people are doing this. More and more organizations are doing this because it's interesting in an hour interview, if you get an hour interview, even if you have several people interviewing them or you spend a day with them. I mean, when we're doing executives, we spend a lot of time with them, right? There's certain filters that we have ourselves and certain blinders we have ourselves that we don't see certain things, all right, when we're interviewing. And that's one of the benefits of having multiple people interview. But it's still in those types of situations, you don't see everything. What happens when you have a really good assessment is you pick up all kinds of different nuances, different aspects of the individual. And one of the things that we always do when we use it, no matter what it's for, whether it's for hiring or team building or coaching or personal development, we validate a part of the assessment to see what the accuracy is. And as you're validating it, one of the neat things about using an assessment is the report comes from a black box, a computer, all right? So you can ask questions and people aren't nearly as defensive as if you would just say, ask the same question without having the report in front of you. For example, there's a general characteristics or behavioral characteristics part of our report. And what we'll do is, you know, we'll ask them to underline those things that they disagree with, and then we'll correct them. But we'll use that as a conversation. The assessment is an opportunity to have a conversation with the person. Don't assume that everything in the report is accurate. But when you have that conversation, all of a sudden, you're starting to learn more about them. So you can have a line there that they don't say is inaccurate, i.e. it is accurate. And then you can say, well, tell me more about when you're in this type of situation. Right. Now, when you are using a quality assessment, you have all those additional insights, so you can start asking the right questions. Now, one of the things that we do is we have a benchmarking process, and we're using artificial intelligence now for our benchmarking process, and it is really incredible because we're looking at behaviors, we're looking at what drives those behaviors or what their motives are, and then we're looking at what their habits are. And from that, we can actually come up with what types of behaviors, motives, and habits are the best fit for that particular job. And then we can measure that in the prospective employee, right? And then you can do it in multiple employees. And all of a sudden you have this incredible information. Now, it could take you 6 months to figure out what the person is like if you don't have a quality assessment. You can figure out in 6 minutes what the person is like if you have a quality assessment. Now, getting to the culture aspect, ours absolutely. I mean, one of the areas is what is their ideal environment? And there's a whole bunch of bulleted items. And what we do in that case is we just have them circle the bullet in front of the item that they agreed to. So all of a sudden, we can see what their ideal environment is. Another page looks at value to the team or value to the organization. So we can see where they are. And we ask them to tell us, you know, what is accurate for those different areas. And it works marvelously because now we have a conversation and discussion. And we also do things where we actually work much more closely with our clients. Most of our assessments are so accurate that most of our clients use the assessment and don't use our additional services. They might use our training, but they don't use our consulting service. But when people are hiring an executive, we actually can go in and measure 6 different components of what the individual is like. And then I get involved and I make suggestions. I look at where the red flags are, and I make suggestions on what types of questions they should be asking in the interview process. And oh my God. All right. When that happens, it's kind of like, holy cow. You know, it's kind of like, how did you know to ask that question? And people will actually say that. And in those types of situations, then you can really get into a really good conversation with them and really know what they're like. And what happens most times, a lot of people hire people that they really like in the interview process. All right. And they don't effectively use assessments, even if they're giving them in their organization. Now we have videos that they can look at to train them how to do that. But what happens is they love them in the interview. So they hire them. And then 3 or 4 months later, they can't stand them anymore. All right. Because they didn't do the right interviewing process. They didn't ask the right questions during the interview process. So even though they loved them 3 or 4 months ago, 6 months from now, they're saying, oh my God, how do I get rid of this person? Right. But then they have to go through the whole process all over again, which is very costly, not just money wise, but it's costly time wise and it's costly opportunity wise. Every time you have to hire somebody because you're asking somebody else to leave, you're going to lose clients, you're going to lose relationships. Right. And then there are all these additional opportunities. So it's very costly to not use an accurate and an effective assessment. And last thing I want to say on that is you need to use an assessment that measures what you feel is important in the job. Right. Myers-Briggs, again, is an excellent assessment. A lot of organizations use it. Academicians love the Myers-Briggs. I know because I used to be an academician. Right. But again, it just looks at how people think. Personally, I'm much more concerned about how they're going to behave, and that's why we focus on using behavioral profile All right. And not just a cognitive profile, because you'd be thinking all kinds of things, but you don't do it. Right. How many times have you thought, you know, Kelly or Todd, that you're going to do this, but, you know, 2 weeks later, it's still not done. Right. So I want to be able to see how they're going to behave.
Yeah. You sounded like my wife there.
Sorry.
Yeah. There's a couple things around here that need to be done that I said I was going to do 2 weeks ago. So we were having a kind of a good discussion, you know, prior to hitting that record button again. We were talking about the coaching industry. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about the different types of testing that we can do, Myers-Briggs, the DISC. You know, we're talking about cognitive versus behavioral, you know, versus, you know, personality and that sort of thing. It seems to me like there are certain, you know, there are a lot of coaching companies out there that utilize a personality test before they bring on, you know, a potential coaching client, or they use that as their hook to bring people in. You know, people are really interested in their, you know, whether their personality is, you know, this, that, or the other thing. What's the driving force behind their personality? What is it that that coaching companies should be using? I mean, is there a definitive answer? Should it be behavioral? Should it be cognitive? Should it be personality?
Well, my answer to that is it depends on what type of coaching you want to do, right? Because you can do business-related coaching. And if that's the case, you should focus on something that deals with cognitive or behavioral or how they're going to act at work. All right. You can do life coaching, which gets into other areas. All right. And then you're probably going to use other types of assessments, and to look at what they're like, as an individual. In most cases, and again, why we lead with the DISC is because no matter what it is that you're doing, it's important to understand how people are going to behave. Right. And it's really helpful to know that. From a coaching perspective, and a lot of coaches don't do this. A lot of coaches take whoever they feel that they can work with, right? Wouldn't it be neat and effective if you could see how you personally relate to the person who you're coaching and see where your blind spots are in relationship to where some of their weaknesses are? Because then you don't have the ability, since it's a blind spot for you and it's a weakness for them, for you to actually identify it or help them identify it and to improve on it. Right. So it's really important to make sure that you understand. We actually have an onboarding and a comparison report where if both people take the individual assessment and then they don't have to take anything else. We just need to we take the data from their individual assessment and we do a comparison report. So if you were coaching me, right, you know, Kelly, and we did this, there would be a page on how to communicate with Michael, how to communicate with Kelly, how not to communicate with Michael, how not to communicate with Kelly. You know, what value do I bring to the team? What value do you bring to the team? Because as a coach, here we are, we're a two-person team, right? In every relationship and as we interact with each other. So that tool is really, really helpful and effective because now I can see as a coach things I have to be more sensitive to, I have to be thinking more about with my particular client. So yes, it's very, very helpful. I mean, you can use our assessment and you could use that for 10, 12, 15 sessions, all right, to get into what the person is like, because we have one assessment that looks at behaviors. It looks at these motives or what drives the behaviors, and it looks at emotional intelligence, right? Emotional intelligence has really come on as a really important, you know, concept and area in the last 15 years or so. And a lot of people say people get hired, you know, from their behavior, and they get fired because of a lack of emotional intelligence, right? So why not look up front at what their emotional intelligence is like so you can see whether you're going to have the right fit? Because cultures are different. Some cultures are really collegial cultures. Some cultures are really competitive cultures, right? So if you have a very, very competitive culture in your organization, somebody's going to react differently regarding their emotional intelligence than if you have a very collegial culture in your organization. Just think of a law firm, right? You know, where you have a lot of, you know, very, very, you know, very, very competitive people. Or think of some real estate companies where they're very, very competitive, right? But you haven't assessed the emotionality of the person that you're bringing on. All of a sudden, they come in and they're a bat out of hell, you know, type of thing. And they're really creating a negative, you know, milieu within the organization. Well, you could have known that up front. And my recommendation in those types of, you know, situations, even though they're a top performer, hey, let them go to, let them go down the street to the other organization and cause hell there. You don't want them doing that in your organization.
Well, I think it also having access to that data, you know, exactly what you talked about in terms of, you know, knowing how to speak to someone, right? You know, I think that from a leadership perspective, this just creates better leaders within the organization, right? It allows you to really to help to foster that person and make sure that they're going to grow from a growth mindset type standpoint and grow into the role that they've been slotted into the company. And it just allows you to really kind of lead them towards, you know, the ultimate path that they want to be a part of, or the path that they ultimately want to be going down within the organization. Whereas if you didn't have that, then you're, you know, as a leader, you're continually guessing and or you're trying to fit them into your own idea or your own box of what that role should be. And you know, trying to force that person into a type of behavioral type standpoint that maybe isn't going to fit within the company, or at least fit within the idea of what the CEO or COO or CFO decides is the right role for that person. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because we actually have an assessment that measures 25 different leadership characteristics, which is really cool because you can see some people that'll be very, very collegial and some people will be very, very competitive. So if we're in a competitive environment, you want somebody who's really going to be really good in sales, not too sharkish, okay, but really good in sales, then you're going to want them to be a little bit more competitive than if it's a true team. You know, and some organizations really have true teams. And in that case, you want somebody who's going to be more collegial. So they're going to have more of a sensitivity to what other people in the team lead, because the value of the team is that everybody brings something that is of quality and importance to the team, but different people may have different areas of expertise and different specialties. Well, when you get two different people that have different opinions in the same specialty, sometimes you need to have somebody who's more collegial. Sometimes you need to have somebody who is more competitive, right? You can also decide whether you want to assign them on something that's really competitive. For example, if you have somebody who is an inside sales agent, right? So they're making telephone calls and they're really on there themselves, right? That's a different type of personality, a different type of personal style than if you have somebody who's working with two or three other people, right, to get the lead or to get in front of that individual. Especially in commercial real estate, it's really interesting. You know, the teams need to be really, really successful. But if you've got somebody who's really, really sharkish, you know, there, then they're going to fight over the commission split and they're going to fight over who's going to do this, that, and the other thing, and they could easily kill the deal. And in a commercial real estate environment, it might take you 4 or 5 years, you know, to get the deal. And all of a sudden, in 4 or 5 minutes, they mess it up and you're pulling your hair out because, oh my God, how did I let this happen? Well, it's too late because they've just taken their $10, $20, $150 million project and gone somewhere else.
Man, I'd love to see these profiles of some of the top leaders within the real estate industry. It would be certainly an interesting perspective to have, you know, considering some of the stuff that's going on right now, currently at the end of December 2022.
You know, it's not just the real estate industry. You know, every industry goes through transitions. You know, and with the interest rates going up as they have over the last 6 or 9 months, it's become much more competitive. And everybody that we work with, you know, has set their goals not in 2022 as far as where they want to be in 2025, but they set them in 2020 or 2021. Okay. And then all of a sudden the environment's shifted dramatically. And that has an impact. Well, do you have the right people? Do they have the right personality? Do they have the right behavioral or motive or EQ or leadership characteristics? Can they handle stress appropriately? Right. So and we have tools that measure all those things, and we have training to show you how to effectively use it. So it is really important. One of the things that you raised, and I just want to share this, give you an idea, because we were talking about this before we taping today. How can you use us to increase your coaching practice? Well, we have the ability, and this is new for us, but we have the ability to for you to license you to using the assessments. And if you're going to use more than 18 or 19 assessments in a 12-month period of time, it pays for you to get a license. And the more you're going to be using, the more it pays for you to get a license. So let's say you did one assessment a week on a prospective client. So 50 assessments over the year. And you gave them an assessment and you comped them on the assessment. And then you use the assessment to better understand what they're like, to better communicate with them, and to better connect with them. And you gave them a half an hour coaching session. All right. And you use the assessment and you hand them the assessment. And, you know, this is the assessment that we're going to use after you debrief them a little bit and show them what you could do as a coach. I mean, that would be a phenomenal way to get new clients, because you're going to know how to connect with them because you know what they're like. Number one. Number two, you're going to have this great tool that you can use for a number of other opportunities. And you have now shown them in a half an hour. You might want to do 45 minutes. You want to give them a whole 50 minutes or an hour session, whatever. Okay. Do one of those a week. And you're going to get a whole bunch of clients. And the neat thing is it's cost effective, because if you're going to do more than 18 or 19 assessments in a year, it's already, the license already paid for itself, but you can do hundreds of assessments for the same price. So we're really excited about this, because this is a whole new area for us.
If you are enjoying this episode, please leave a 5-star review at your favorite podcast provider.
You've brought up transitions in the past, and I would love to know, speaking of transitions, who Dr. A was like at 10 years old.
Oh my God. What was I like at 10 years old? Well, my brother had cerebral palsy from birth. So from when I was 10 years old, I was basically my brother's keeper. All right. Because I was the first child, he was the second child. All right. We were like 3 years apart. So when I was 10, he was 7. And when I would go out and play with my friends, my brother was with me in his wheelchair, and I would wheel him out there and he would be with me. So we would do stuff. And on the weekends, if we go, you know, play football, you know, or something like that, or a sport, he was with me. When I went to religious services, my brother was with me. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, wherever Michael was, that's where Kenny was, you know, type of thing. So when I was 10 years old, that's what I was like. And that has had a significant impact on my life in a number of different ways, because a lot of people are motivated by money. Yeah, I'm motivated by money, but what I'm really motivated by, my true passion is to help others, and to do things so others can have a better life. I mean, I taught at Texas A&M University for a little over 30 years. Okay. And at a university professor, I didn't make much money. Right. But for the last 20 years, I was teaching the small classes of 400 to 450 students. All right. And I would have, you know, typically two of those sections a semester. So I was teaching anywhere from 1500 to 2000 students a year. Right. And for me, I was having a significant opportunity to impact other people's lives through what they learned in the class. And even though I retired from A&M over a decade ago, I still run into students and they still come up and to say hi to me. I just, last week, a student through social media says, "Dr. A, I can't believe I have found you." You know, it's going, "What do you mean you have found me?" You know, and he said, "You know, I really loved your class and I'd like to learn from you now." It's kind of like, wow, you know, so I feel great about that. That he's willing to do that. Now, you know, am I going to charge him some money? Yeah, I'm going to charge him some money, but believe me, it's not about the money. So that's one of the, so that went on, you know, until I was actually married, because that's when I separated basically, you know, from the family. In fact, the first 2 years of my college education, I went to Penn State, and I went to a Commonwealth campus, because of the responsibility of my brother. I didn't go to main campus until the third year, because you had to go.
There's a lot of kids that decide they want to be an astronaut or race car driver, or in my case, a Greyhound bus driver, which is a true story. Do you feel that pushed you along the route that you took in life?
Most definitely. you know, it pushed me, you know, and I have a whole bunch of positive feelings about that. And I have a whole bunch of negative feelings, you know, because as a 10-year-old, you know, all my other friends didn't have to worry about their brothers or sisters. Okay. You know, and here I was, you know, literally my brother's keeper, in a lot of ways, in a lot of situations. You know, so there are those types of things. But yeah, it definitely had an impact. And if you go through any of our training programs, or you know, or the, I mean, Kelly, you've been through that. Todd, you've been through that. You've seen me train. I'm passionate about what I do, and I love asking questions because that's how I know what people need.
I'm curious about some of your past students that some of us may or may not know who they are. Can you drop some names for us, there, Dr. A?
Well, I'll throw some football players out there, okay? Mm-hmm. Because they're typically the most well known. Von Miller, Super Bowl MVP a number of years ago with Denver was stuck with me in my class. Ryan Tannehill, who was quarterback, okay, still professional quarterback, doing well, was stuck with me. Matt Millen. Who used to be with Detroit, who was actually the general manager, Detroit Lions, was a student of mine when I was a grad assistant at Penn State. And I have some very interesting stories about Matt. And for some reason, if any of you know Matt Millen, I've been trying to get in touch with him for like a decade now, but his handlers won't let me get close to him. I'd love for Matt to give me a call because I'd love to get together with him. Just say this is the guy who did the power play. Okay. And he will know exactly who I am. And the guy who we got the grand in aid, fictitious grand in aid, Matt Millen actually got a grand in aid for my best friend's son, who happened to be also named Matt. And it was really cool. I asked Matt if he would, if he could get me an autograph of Joe Paterno, because Matt at that time was one of the co-captains. All right. Of the football team. And I forgot about it near the end of the, and I said, it's not going to peck your grade at all, positive or negative. You know, I'm just asking, you know, this favor. And at near the end of the semester, he comes in with a cylinder and he says, here. And I said, well, what is this? And he said, well, open it. So I opened it and I opened it up and oh my God, it was a grand in aid to be a football player at Penn State. Okay. And this kid was just born, by the way. All right. But at Penn State, it was signed by the president. It was signed by Joe Paterno. It was signed by the chancellor. And instead of the athletic director, it was signed by Matt Millen. So it was void. Wow. Okay. But that was a phenomenal gift. And make a long story short, I had the opportunity of talking with this Matt, not Matt Millen, but the other Matt. A couple months ago, and reminded him of the story. He said, Michael, I have that on my desk. Okay, because he's so proud of it.
Wow.
You know, so I mean, I've had some cool experience. I had an interesting experience with Von Miller. You know, I've been a very, very fortunate guy. So Matt Millen, if you're hearing this, please give me a holler.
If you weren't doing this right now in your life, what would be your backup?
Oh, I have no idea. I mean, people ask me, when am I going to retire? And I say, my plan is, as long as this is working, I'm working. And I plan to die with my boots on, you know, because I'm always learning and hopefully getting better, you know, but for sure, I'm always learning. and I mean, if I could do it all over again, which is a different question, if I could do it all over again, I probably would have been a real estate attorney. Okay. Because a lot of our clients and accounts are residential real estate. I love real estate. I happen to own some real estate myself. So I understand the industry really well. I've been working with the industry since, believe it or not, 1983. So probably because I would have loved to put the deals together, you know, be that type of real estate attorney. But that is the water, you know, under the bridge or over the dam, so to speak. Now, I did visit Harvard because a good friend of mine actually graduated from Harvard, and he was teaching at Harvard at the time. And I went up there and I visited with my best friend, and we sat in this class that Jeff did. But anyhow, we went to the law school, and we went into if you ever have the opportunity to go to Harvard, the law school, right, go to the main classroom. And when you walk in, it is just, I don't know if they've remodeled it since we were there, because it was a while now, but it is just an awesome experience, because they have these huge pictures of all these chief justices that actually went to Harvard, right? And at the time, they have all these old desks that people have actually had etched in initials and stuff like that. And you could walk around and sit there and be saying to us, geez, did one of the chief justices, was this a chair that he used? Okay, you know, type of thing. You know, so there's those types. So anyhow, the only reason I'm sharing that is because I stopped over in the dean's office and the admissions office, and I got an application for the Harvard Law School. And so did my best friend. And I went back, and my wife at the time, and I said, you know, hey, I'm thinking about going back to law school. I'm like, keep in mind, I already had two master's degrees, because I had my master's in clinical psych. I had my MBA, and I had a PhD in business management. And I'm saying to my wife at the time, I want to go back to school. She said, the hell you are. I've already gone through enough of the shit with you. I'm not doing this anymore. All right. So, and of course, she didn't use that language, but that was my interpretation. So needless to say, I don't have a law degree.
And you didn't even say, I mean, when you're talking about law school, you're not just talking about any law school. You're talking about Harvard Law School on top of that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I could have gotten in or not, but that's the application that I got.
You were in at one point because you saw the room. So you're in.
Well, I'll tell you that's one of the most impactful single experiences that I've ever had, truthfully. All right. So if anybody out there is listening to this has an opportunity, especially live in the Boston area, again, I don't know if they remodeled it or not, but just imagine. I'm a Philly boy. So I grew up in Philadelphia. It's kind of like when you go to Independence Mall and sit one of those. Did Ben Franklin sit here? You know, did Jefferson, did he sit there?
Have you noticed over the past couple of years, because we've went through some crap over the last couple of years in terms of the world, have you noticed a change in people's DISC or the behaviors changing due to the uncontrolled environments that they are living in?
That's a very interesting question. It's interesting that in our certification program, we actually have a graph, okay, that looks at percentages that are primarily D, I, S, or C, okay, or their lead major DISC, D, I, S, or C, is in those different areas. And there are shifts, right? There are definitely R shifts. Now, one of the neat things about our assessments is they're international. They're in over 40 different languages. So we actually have norms, and we actually know what the percentages are in different cultures. Okay, in China, in Russia, in Germany, in England, in France, in Brazil. Okay, so we have all of those in Canada, obviously in the US for sure. You know, so we already know what those profiles are. Now, for those who are out there that might be using a different DISC, shame on you. But if you're using a different DISC, those statistics are typically from that DISC assessment. All right. So it depends on how accurate that DISC assessment is. It depends on how many people are in their study to determine whether there's a D, I, S, or C, or what the combination is. My advice always is figure out what that individual, figure out what their blending is, if they're not one of those 7% that's a much I, S, or C. Okay. Because everybody's different. Everybody's different individual. Now, have I seen a shift? Yes. All right. I think it seems like our culture anymore seems to be less tolerant of other people's opinions, right? And the way they do things. It still amazes me that people who may have been lifelong friends might have different political stances on issues, and then one person isn't willing to talk to the other anymore. It's kind of like, why is this going on? You know, it's very disheartening for me individually, but you know, as many of us are very fond to say, it is what it is. You know, so it's just important to realize what that person's style is. And again, if you're using a quality assessment, you know, from a business perspective, you know, you have some significant insight into what the person is like and whether they have a tolerance. right? You can have somebody who's a very, very high C, okay, and a very, very high D. We refer to them as an implementer, right? Because they're task-oriented and they like to get things done and, you know, competitive, so they go after it, all right? But they can have a different motive set. And because of what they're motivated by, for example, one of them is referred to as traditional. Well, traditional is like to have rules and regulations. So it's not that unusual for somebody who's traditional to be very religious and to be less tolerant of other people's religious values or what they think are right or wrong. And I don't want to get into this politically, but you know, you have some people who believe in choice as far as abortion, and some people believe that abortion is a cardinal sin, right? And then when they get in a conversation, what does that do to their relationship? Right. Well, it depends on what your motives are. Okay. As to how strongly you're going to be opinionated regarding different things. Right. So do I see a shift? I do see a shift. But as I just said a moment ago, you know, it is what it is. And we just have to learn how to deal with it because people are people.
Is there kind of a baseline, in terms of all of the assessments that you've done across, say, the United States, where you could confidently say the majority of the population is ID or, you know, SC, or is there kind of a baseline there? And further to that, if there is a baseline in the US, then that means that there's baselines in Germany, in Russia, and all of these other countries. And I'm curious how those baselines compare to each other, if there's any correlation or if they're completely different culture to culture.
Well, culture to culture, there's going to be some differences for sure, right? It's interesting. German culture is very similar to the U.S. culture as far as our DISC assessment is concerned, all right? But there's other assessments that are very different. China is different. Russia is different, you know, as far as behavioral. Now, the important aspect to keep in mind is behaviors are just one aspect of our personality. So when you're looking at the person, you can't just look at the DISC and make those assumptions. So are there bench lines or are there different, you know, types of norms or what you might expect? Sure. Right. But again, when you're working with somebody, you really need to see what they're like as an individual and not make some assumptions that, well, 43% of the population is this style. So that's the likelihood that they're this style. That's not going to do you much good when you're interacting with an individual. Okay. When I'm interacting with you, Kelly, I need to understand what you're like as an individual. Todd, when I'm interacting with you, I need to know what you're like as an individual. And I'm astute enough that in most cases, I can pick that up without even giving the assessment. All right. But most people are not. So give them the assessment, especially let me go back to our license opportunity again. I mean, you can give all kinds of people the assessment, give it to your family members, you know, give it to people that you work with. If you're a church organization, give it to people in your church or have the church buy it for everybody. I mean, it's really incredible. And then people can interact with others and know what other strengths are and others' limitations. So you can be more effective, whether it's a job or whether it's a family or whether it's a religious organization or any type of volunteer organization. And when I do consulting, what I tell people to do is figure out what somebody's strengths are. Put them in situations where their strengths can be utilized. Know what somebody's limitations are. I don't like to use the word weaknesses. I like to use limitations. Know what their limitations are. Keep them away from those types of situations unless you want to have that as a growth opportunity. But don't immerse them in an area where they have a lot of different limitations. It's going to be frustrating for them. They're not going to be successful. They're going to get out of the situation. They're going to want to procrastinate doing things because it's not a comfortable place for them, right? So those are wonderful ways to use these types of things. One of the biggest problems I have is people want to pigeonhole people into a certain behavioral style, right? They're a D. Oh, wow. And some people wear D as a badge of courage. And some people wear D as, oh, my God, you know, how dare you, you know, be something. Please don't put a label on somebody. You wouldn't like people putting a label on you. Don't be putting labels on people. That's another beauty of using our assessment because there are so many different blends. And by using a quality assessment, you can see what those blends are, right? And I've been told this and I don't have any real factual data to back this up, but The next accurate disc, I've been told, only looks at 24 different behavioral stars. Ours looks at 384, and that's one of the reasons why people tell me all the time that ours is in their experience, the most accurate one that they've ever done. Right? Every once in a while, people tell me not, but in most cases, almost all cases, you know, that's not what I hear.
As a business owner, and I guess that we've all been there at some point, either dating, you picked the wrong person, you may have hired the right person, the wrong person, and it usually goes on that gut feeling, right?
Yeah.
So let's say I need to hire 20 or 30 different people for the same position. Is there a way for me to look at the disc and find out, okay, this is the perfect person, or are there other options out there for me?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's where our artificial intelligence program comes in, because what we do is we look at behaviors, we look at motives, and we look at habits of individuals. All right. And what we do is we create a benchmark for the position out of the 70 plus characteristics that we're going to measure with those three different concepts. Right. And sometimes we'll throw in the emotional intelligence too. These different concepts. What is the best profile that leads to performance? For example, we've done a study with a real estate company. And as far as the office managers are concerned, we were able to come up with a profile with very, very high level of confidence that this is correct, of somebody who is going to have twice the net profit and twice the increase in agent count, all right, because of their behavioral styles and motives and their habits. Okay, so it's really, really important to have a really good, accurate benchmark, because especially if you're going to be hiring 20 or 30 people, I mean, that's very costly, right? The cost of wrong hire, and research suggests that this is very, very accurate percentage-wise, is going to cost you anywhere from 25% to 200% of the first year's compensation. Now, compensation is salary, fringe benefits, bonuses, stock options, whatever. So if you're hiring a senior level person and they're costing you hundreds of thousands of dollars, then just look at what quarter of that is and look at what twice that amount is. And that's how much you're going to be spending, all right, by making the wrong decision. So what if you're buying an assessment that costs you X amount of money? All right. You know, so what if you're going to have a benchmark and that might cost you some money? I mean, the amount of money that it saves you, the amount of aggravation that it saves you, the amount of frustration, okay, and the amount of positive impact you're going to have on that person's life and other people's lives, all right, is just exponentially, you know, more valuable. So it is really important. And again, we have excellent assessment tools. We have a process that does that. And we're very proud of it, and we're very successful.
Yeah. So I for the longest time, I guess I probably took one of these, personality disc, quote unquote assessments. And for the longest time, I thought that I was a high D, high D, low Y. SC was almost non-existent. And when I took your assessment, your disc assessment, kind of flipped the script on me a little bit and suggested that I was a high ID, right? And SC absolutely registered on the scale, but nowhere near as high as the I or the D. Do you think that people's personalities can flip, over time? Let's just say everything being equal. Let's say 2 years ago, I took your assessment. Then I took it 2 years on, 2 years later, and things kind of flipped around. Number one, that's the first question. Can people's personalities change, their behavior systems change? And number two, would it then be important for a company to really invest in these assessments, to have their employees assessed every like 12 or 24 or 36 months?
Well, let me answer the first one. So let me ask you a question first. How accurate was it?
Well, your assessment was, like I said, it was 99.8% accurate. Like it was
okay,
just right
so,
up there.
So that was an accurate reflection of your personal behavioral style. Now, can people's right. behavioral styles change? Have your behaviors ever changed?
Sure.
Sure. Yes. The answer is yes. All right. So, I mean, I actually wrote something a couple of years ago. It's only 3 or 4 pages long, but it looks at 24 different myths regarding the disc. All right. And one of those myths out there is behaviors don't change. That's so ridiculous. All right. Yes, they change. Now, the issue then becomes when you're measuring that change, is the difference in the assessment because it's not a good tool or because the person's behavior has changed? So that's really important, right? It's called reliability, right? Reliability is consistency. It's reliable. Yes, it measures the same thing, right, over and over and over again. Validity is when it's accurate in what it measures. So they're two different things. But our assessment is very, very reliable, right? Which means that if your behavior changes, all right, we're going to pick it up. That's validity, but it is consistent. So if you take the assessment 1 month and then 3 months later you take it, there might be some minor changes or minor differences. Our assessment is going to pick it up because it is so sensitive, right? Now, some of that might be because of measurement error, right? Even though our assessment is very good, all assessments have measurement error. So it's important to realize that. Again, it's important to work with an organization that understands the statistical aspect of it. There's a lot of people out there that sell assessments that have no clue regarding really what's going on. So when you're picking a company, make sure you pick somebody who really has expertise, you know, in the quality of the assessment and the concepts and how to use it, right? Because it's very difficult. So yes, can behaviors change? Absolutely. Now, can what motivates somebody or drives that behavior, can that change? That's typically more stable. That's more difficult to change. But can that change? Yes. I mean, you go through a life-changing situation. God forbid you're diagnosed with cancer or you're diagnosed with a terminal illness. Is that going to change your behavior? In most people, it's going to, right? They start thinking about different things and they change their behavior. Or somebody in your life, we refer to it as a significant life event. So if there's a significant life event, it can change. Now, getting to your second question, and that is how often should the assessment be redone, all right? If somebody's behavior has changed, a lot of organizations take excellent technicians and they make them into managers, right? Well, if they're flexible, you know, their behavior might change. Well, if that's the case, after they've been in the job for 6 or 12 months, have them do another assessment, right? So they can see it, right? What we recommend regarding our assessments, since they are so stable, but they are so accurate, that every 3 or 4 years, if somebody's in the same position, have them retake the assessment just to see what's going on. If you're thinking of giving them a promotion, take the assessment, right? How much is it going to cost you if you put a person in the wrong position when you're moving them around in relationship to what does the assessment cost? Nothing compared to the problems that it can cause if you put somebody in the wrong position. So those are the times where we would recommend that you have them retake it. There's a behavioral change. You're asking them to be in a significantly different role. You want to make sure that you're making that from accurate understanding. Okay. You know, or, you know, there's a significant life event. So those are reasons why it might change. And some could say there's a fourth reason, and that reason, who the heck knows why? Okay, people change their behaviors.
All right, Dr. A, tell us, tell everybody, tell our listeners how they can get a hold of you and how they can potentially even go about ordering some assessments.
It's real easy. Contact me personally at dr.a@abelson.net. Just spell it right, ABELSON.net. Or contact us at succeed@abelson.net. Or go to our website, abelson.net. All right, or contact us or get a hold of us through LinkedIn or Instagram or Facebook.
Again, as always, thank you guys so much for tuning in, and on to the next show.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to Gain the Passion. Please rate, review, and share the podcast. And don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button.